some of you have seen this before because I put it on every day. This is session three, Cynthia Gustafson. It's September 5th, 3:45. God calls your name and shouts and whispers through the fire. I put this on every day because I love it. It's difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. It's not an idea that most people think of, that they can't live life without poetry. I feel that way, and I get much of the news from poetry for me. And I thought that was wonderful because William Carlos Williams is actually a medical doctor. Okay, today, and that thing is noisy when I have lunch, so I'm going to turn it off in between times. Today we're going to talk a little bit about going through the fire. Let me start with the quotation again. Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I'll be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. And that's the part that we're talking about today, is the walking through fire. And I think that metaphor is pretty much understood by everyone as when you have adversity, when you're going through some kind of adversity. And what it says in the Bible, it says two things. You shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. And so I want to talk about both of these through poetry. And I have a stack of poems that I could put on there that are all about going through the flames, going through the fire. And I'm just going to use a few of them just to get some conversation going. But before I start showing a poem, what is your idea, any of your ideas about, are you closer to God as you walk through the fire, or are you further away from God as you walk through the fire? Has anybody thought about that?
It's kind of a back and forth, I think.
Uh-huh.
I mean, sometimes you feel closer and sometimes you're doubting and sometimes you don't have a way of connecting, or you can't make yourself connect.
Mm-hmm. How about?
I can always connect, but sometimes I'm really angry with him.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why are you letting this happen? Yeah. Right. When I ask this question, the first thing that pops into my head is what happened to the Jews during the Holocaust? Mm-hmm. And of course, that question is different for every single individual person. And some of those Jews became secularized and said, God wasn't with me and I don't believe anymore. And some of the Jews became deeper in their faith because through all of that they could feel God even though they felt forsaken by everyone else. And so I think this is highly individualized. You know, who we are before we go through the fire. Are there any kind of supports for us as we go through the fire? And also, I think what you said, what part are we at? Is this the beginning, the middle, the end? Is God there the whole time, part of the time? And we'll talk about some of those.
He's there the whole time, but you are not.
For us, right, right. The connection,
that's
what I'm talking about. Okay, let me begin with this poem. And if you were at the reading last night, I did read this poem. It's called Christmas Child. And I'll go over this because this was a terribly traumatic event in my life. I was robbed at gunpoint in front of my own home when I lived in Louisiana. And the person who did that robbing was a young kid. I would say maybe 16, maybe 17 years old, and held the gun, and he was so nervous that the gun was shaking up and down like this. And it was very traumatic for all of us concerned. But anyway, this is the poem that I wrote about that. We call it Christmas Child. I've been thinking lately about a Vietnam War vet who could not forget what he had learned, saw too well where hell stood, close enough to be smuggled in by dog, child, or woman. Hell lurking at fence end between rows of a green field, outside an open window, by the mailbox, in his guts. I had listened to him one Christmas morning muttering how he had thrown away his wife, kid, and Minnesota farm where he had it made, land paid for, friendly folks, men who remembered his touchdown on homecoming. He rejected that Shetland pony and picket fence life. Now, I am like him. Cannot sit with my back to a window or drive to the grocer's after dark. Can no longer control my heart's pounding as I hear a car approach. I choose not to plug in Christmas, red, blinking. Not to trust guardian angels who sing of peace. I cannot forget. I still see the car rounding my street, screeching its brakes. A thief demanding Christmas money. The hands of a child jerking a silver gun, holding it to my face, twitching, holding it like something hot, blinding in intensity, brilliant as the Christmas star, but much, much closer. Now, the reason I use this poem is because there are so many conflicting feelings for me in this, that this happened at Christmas time, and why was this child looking for money? He was looking to buy Christmas presents. What does Christmas mean when you buy Christmas presents from robbing somebody at gunpoint? I mean, all of these images are just going through my head. And the other part of this is that it really made me stop trusting people. I have been a very, very trusting person my whole life, and this incident happened and it stopped. It stopped in its tracks. I didn't trust anybody after that for a while. And I'm wondering, if you read this poem, you know, I'm contrasting this at the end, that gun was brilliant as the Christmas star, but was much, much closer. You know, think for a minute, was there something that, you know, any of you, something that happened to any of you when you wondered, you know, where was God during this? And maybe something that actually kind of shook you and decided, you know, made you think, rethink that question.
I can't help but feel that there must have been a time, but maybe it's that one represses those things.
Well, that's true. It's not something that you want to remember. Unless it's
there's something like that.
Yeah, really huge, then you want to forget it and can't. Yeah.
So we had a child who was born dead, and it was difficult to find.
Right.
God.
Where is that grace in this? Here. Nowhere at all. That would be very, very difficult. And how did you eventually resolve that?
I don't know, but if I ever did,
you did.
There's been a lot of tears.
Yeah. Yeah, I think some people try to dismiss it as best they can by saying the child is in heaven and the child is okay. It's only me that's really hurting right now. I'm grieving. The child is okay. But boy, it doesn't take your grief away at all. Or even to try and think, why did this happen? But it, you know, this whole question of going through the fire and you shall not be burned, how long ago was that? I'm assuming many years. Many years ago, and yet it's 60. Still there.
Oh yeah, I remember the birthday.
It's still there,
right? And it's difficult to talk about.
And if we read this, it says, "When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you." It obviously did not consume you, because you are here, and you're leading your life. And I don't know
know a whole lot about you, but it didn't consume you. But let me ask you, did the fire burn you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And see, that's the question that I want to ask here. As we walk through the fire, how is it that we cannot be burned? And I, obviously, this passage does not mean physically burned. But that's the question that I'm asking. And for those of you who haven't been in my groups before, I don't lecture. I just kind of throw a lot of stuff out. Because I just want to stir up the pot, you know, think about some of these other things. Okay, here's another. This is a poem that's not quite so heavy. It's a silly little poem which I wrote about my husband. Actually, it's about me and my husband when we go to a movie together. And I'll tell you what the last line of this means when we get there. At the movie, he says, "What's in your purse?" Between the chase scene and the love scene on the big screen, "I'm hungry, got any food?" As quietly as I can, I send my hand into the wasteland of my purse, combing through shredded Kleenex and sticky pennies, rubber bands, brushes, and keys. He knows I will find food. He sees the crackers I sneak into my pocket as we leave the cafe. The Starlight mints I graciously accept and never eat, but store away in the bottom shelves of this purse. And there are peanut M&Ms just in case I get caught in traffic and don't get home for lunch. I can munch on protein and chocolate and survive another hour in this hungry transitional place. I hand him a Tootsie Roll, left from Halloween, I say, and he winks and knows it is a life-saving purse, carrying food which does not spoil, a loyal purse which insures against the bare cupboards of childhood. Okay, I said I would say to you what that last line means, a purse which insures against the bare cupboards of childhood. I don't know if any of you grew up hungry as a child. People who are older who grew up during the Depression definitely know that. But I just grew up poor. I didn't grow up in the Depression. I just grew up poor. And we just didn't have enough food, and I was always hungry. And it didn't occur to me until about 5 years ago that that's why I am never without food. I am hung up in my room up there in Chalet 11. I'm not letting the mice get at it, it's all in really nice containers. But you see, I have to have food just in case they run out or I don't like it or something like that. And my husband laughs at it, you know, this thing about the purse, but he knows there's always food in that purse. Now, the reason I put this on here is to look at this again, which says, you can walk through the fire, but you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. Obviously, this being hungry during childhood didn't consume me. I got through childhood, I survived, I'm plenty healthy, I've got plenty of food now whenever I want it. But it did burn me. It did. I still have that burn. And it took me a long time to figure out, why do I have all this food in my purse? And that is the reason. I finally figured it out. Because I live in a city. If you don't live in a city, you don't feel like this. But if you live in a city, you know you're going to get in a traffic jam sometime. And you can get really hungry. You know, so I just have to have something in there just in case. Do any of you, have any of you done that or felt like that? Maybe none of you.
A fairy life.
You what?
A fairy life. You have to have. If you live on an island and.
Oh, yes.
You know, you always carry a little something in case. There's
right.
Nothing open.
Right, right. And you know, it really wouldn't hurt we humans to go a whole day without food. I mean, it really wouldn't hurt, you know, let alone a couple hours. But, So when I started thinking about why did I have this compulsion, you know, to have food in my purse, and I know where that comes from. There's a reason for that. There's a reason I'm doing that. And so that, so there was a burn. There was a burn there, but it didn't. It didn't consume. It didn't consume me. I do know people that it has consumed. Oh gosh, I'm trying to think of her name now. She's a country singer. Oh, one of the Judds, the one that's really heavy right now. Yeah. One of them's Naomi, and I forget, is Naomi the younger one that's fairly heavy, that's not the mother? So. Okay. I heard her interviewed one day, and she said, I have a hard time not eating whatever I want to because I starved so much in childhood. Mm-hmm. It was never enough food, and I now realize that, and I'm trying to change that. Mm-hmm. But so that was another person that I heard say that, but it had started to consume her. So that's something to think about. Okay, here's a poem that I use with a lot of my clients. This poem is about depression, and it's interesting because I don't use this with men. Men don't they don't seem to relate to this, but women do. It's called "No Geysers Lifted Nor Flowers Bloomed." I wanted to scream, but the windows were open, as my neighbor picked flowers, the delicate pastel kind to be set on a yellow checkered cloth while her children eat cookies. I felt the yell rise to my lips like a geyser pool filling before it shooting up, rising, steaming water spinning into my throat until my lips plugged its escape. I wanted to scream, but I had long ago forgotten how to bellow like a lion with a haunting belly growl, its neck raised, arched, its claws carving into dried clay. My scream became a yawn as I retreated to the safety of a goose down comforter and a dark, no dream sleep where no geysers lifted nor flowers bloomed. The reason I put this on here is because I want to ask the question, how do we find God talking to us if we are at that place? You know, if we are feeling depression. And I'm not talking about somebody who's clinically depressed a lot. I'm talking about the kind that we all get to sometime. You know, and it doesn't last, but we're all there sometime. And I know what it feels like to lay on the couch and just not want to move. How does God talk to us in those kinds of times? And here we're talking about, again, going through the fire. As we go through the fire, we will not be burned, we will not be consumed. How do we get through those kinds of times without letting them consume us? Does anybody have any thoughts on how to do that? Or any time that you have heard God talk to you when you've been in feeling that kind of way?
Take a deep breath.
Good start.
Hold it and let it out slowly.
Yeah.
Ask for help.
Yeah. Sometimes listen. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes those are very quiet times. You know, here I'm talking about somebody laying in bed with a goose down comforter over them. That can be a very quiet time, which can be a good time to listen. You know, if we'll allow ourselves to do that, if we'll allow ourselves to start praying or meditating during those kinds of times instead of dwelling, you know, on the other. But I think one of the questions that I'm asking in all five of these days is, or bringing up, is that God both shouts to us and whispers to us. And in one of those quiet times, you know, it might be a whisper that we have to listen for. It could be a shout, you know, if somebody finally says to you, hey, get out of that place and get going. So, you know, you need to take care of yourself and do something. That might be that kind of a shout. But oftentimes it's not. It's a whisper. Okay. What did I say? I have a lot of these. This is the poem I'm going to put on. Because this was a woman, and this is not me. This was a woman And if you're, again, if you're at my reading last night, I read this one. But this was a woman who had been married for 65 years to the same man, and he had gotten Alzheimer's disease. And she'd been taking care of him for quite a while, but he'd gotten to the point where he would run out in the street, and it wasn't safe anymore. She just couldn't take care of him anymore. And I, as a social worker, had to help her find a nursing home for him, and it was the most difficult thing in her entire life. Talk about walking through the fire. This was walking through the fire for her. This is called the Icebox. Her 80-year-old heart beat like a captured bird, but she held him with a steady hand until help came. That same body wiped his drool, spoke for him, dressed and cleaned him, walked down aisles old slow with him. With clenched jaw, she learned his diagnosis, stood stiff, then smiled as she thanked the doctor for his kindness. With precision, she packed pictures of pajamas he'd need at the rest home, drove him there, settled him. In her empty bedroom, she held herself and said it had to be, then slept a restless sleep, 3 hours maybe. Friends insisted, take care of yourself. So she bought something new to fill the emptiness. And when the Sears men in gray jumpsuits brought the new icebox to replace the old one, her body shook with tears as she cradled the used machine on its path to the waiting truck. And nothing they said and nothing she did could stop the metal-on-metal wrenching of the gears as the years rolled backward onto the truck until her steady hand let go. Tomorrow she would tell him all about the ice water in the door and special compartments. But of course, he knew of those, and she would hold him with a steady hand. And I would ask the question here, how does a woman who's going through this survive it? How does a woman who's going through something like this walk through the fire without getting burned? What if she were your neighbor, what could we as Christians do to help someone like this walk through the fire without getting burned?
Be a compassionate neighbor and perhaps do things with that person. I mean, go to lunch or
right, because
help her in the garden.
She's had a companion her whole life, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's had a companion. So that's the first thing you could think of. Yeah, she's going to need somebody to fill that kind of a void, right? Maybe even, you wouldn't know if she had transportation, but maybe taking her to the nursing home back, helping that way. Saying to her, yes, it was time for you to do that. That was the right thing to do in supporting her
to
in that decision, those kinds of things. And I think, I think this, when we talk about God's work and will in the world, we need to talk about the people in this world who do God's will. What is it that makes the kingdom of God? I had a professor once who said, the kingdom of God comes when kingdom deeds are done. Which I think is really an interesting way to think about it, that we can all do what we call kingdom deeds, which help people walk through the fire. Don't let that woman go through the fire alone, or in your case, don't do this alone. Find people, to support you. When my husband had his car accident, there was this enormous, enormous support that we felt from all over, and that helped us get through this fire without being consumed. I still think that we get burns from walking through the fire. Those don't go away, but that's different than being consumed by it.
It's very difficult to ask for help.
Yes, it is. It's incredibly difficult. And I think that's something that people in God's church, need to be very assertive in looking where we can help. And like I know with my husband's accident, people were always saying, if there's anything I can do, just tell me. I mean, that was the same phrase.
Doing that, I think
if there's anything I can do, And the thing is that those are the people that are difficult to ask to do something. It's much better to look really carefully and say specifically, do you need a meal tonight? You know, do you need a ride somewhere? It's so much easier for the person who's walking through the fire to be able to say yes or no. Oh yeah, that would be absolutely wonderful if you would do that. But the person who's walking through the fire, if they have to figure out exactly what their needs are and tell another person, that's difficult. Mm-hmm. It's real difficult. So it was nice of all the people to say, if there's anything I can do, let me know. But it didn't help a lot. Right. Yeah.
I think there's certain kinds of things that people relate to easier than others, like illness and accidents.
Yes.
People relate to, but some things they're embarrassed or don't know how to deal with.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the Alzheimer's thing is wonderful. Uh-huh. My mother has that, and my father's elderly caregiver, and their friends are dead. I mean, they're old. Mm-hmm. And so it's very much an alone thing, you know.
Right.
The younger generation isn't there to visit.
Right. Yeah. And we know that being a caregiver for an Alzheimer's person is one of the most difficult things in the entire
very
world.
Lonely.
Yeah. And that's just part of it. It's just the loneliness.
And another thing that I think, at least in my day, that people were uncomfortable with was miscarriage.
Right. Wasn't talked about at all.
You didn't bring it up.
No. No.
So then this person who had the tremendous loss had no support on me.
Right.
And had no way to talk about it. Right. And that's probably one of the most helpful thing, not maybe more helpful, but to be able to talk about a problem or a grief or,
right.
Well, it is a grieving period.
Yeah, you know, this brings up some research that I read a couple of months ago, which I think is absolutely wonderful. And, you know, some people would just chalk this up to science, but I really think this is incredible because this is how God planned all of this. And that is that there have been studies with Vietnam War veterans with PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're now using CAT scans to watch brain activity in the brain, and they took two groups of veterans and did CAT scans on them just after they had talked about their war experiences to see how their brains lit up as they were thinking about these horrible, really horrendous war experiences. And what happened is that the frontal lobe lit up, which is where our memory is, and the very, very back animal brain lit up, which is where our feelings, our deep feelings are. And then they put these men into two groups, and one of the groups talked weekly about their feelings, you know, what was going on, and the other group didn't. I mean, they went on their, you know, their own lives. And after 6 months, they did the CAT scans again and talked, you know, brought up these horrendous experiences. And the group that had been talking about their experiences still lit up here where the memory is, because the memory was never going to go away. But the feeling part of the brain wasn't lighting up, or it wasn't as bright as it was before. And so it was almost as if, in the process of talking about our feelings, they dissipate. And, you know, psychotherapists have known this for a long time. We didn't know scientifically how this happened, and we still don't know how it happens. We just know that now it can be shown on a CAT scan that it does happen. And it's the same thing. If it's something nobody will talk to you about, how do you get it out? How do you, you know, how do you resolve it? You can't resolve it.
So but I think this younger generation is more open.
Yes, mm-hmm. About almost everything. Yeah,
there's not so many secrets.
Right. Yeah, that's a definite improvement. Okay. All right. I'm going to put this one on. Let me put this one on. This is called loss. And I put this one in here because any kind of loss can't trigger this feeling of walking through the fire. You know, we think loss of, you know, death certainly is going to do it, but there are so many other losses that can also trigger this. Loss of a job, loss of a home, loss of all kinds of things. This is called loss. It's the goodbyes that draw, like magnets, water to the edge of my eyes. Goodbyes to kittens left at the pound, the sound of mewing as I pull away. Goodbyes to neighbors I never shared coffee with until the for sale sign came between us. Goodbyes to cars I bought new and let rust, and to books whose ends came too soon, to Christmas trees in February and cut roses wilting in glass vases. Father, I was so young and not at home, but I would have kissed you goodbye and passed my thumb over the smooth skin on the back of your hand the way you used to stroke mine when I was small and curled into your lap. With each new loss, I align myself with the force of your thumb waving back and forth along some imaginary magnetic line worn smooth from too many and too early leavings. But I think, you know, this talks a little bit about other kinds of losses. I have a lot of friends who now have dogs, it seems like they all got them at the same time, who are just not going to last very much longer. And those dogs have become as close to the family as a human member of that family, or cats, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, or a horse, or, you know, that.
That's happened in our family.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge loss. And if you talk to somebody who really doesn't understand how close you are to that animal, they just go, you know, just not going to understand. Yeah, it's just dog, go get another one, you know?
My husband said to our daughter, who was married 2 weeks ago, who was home for a week before the wedding, "Well, we're not going to be buying any more 50-pound bags of dog food for Sadie." And I said, "Now, Katie, listen." I said, "It's not just that she's getting old." I mean, I knew, but that was what he was saying, that she may not live in a 50-pound bag. Mm-hmm. But I said, "You know, she is older, and her appetite isn't so good anymore." And, you know, if you have a 50-pound bag of dog food, it gets wormy and buggy, and then we have all these little bugs flying all over.
Good thinking. Fast thinking. Yeah. But that's interesting, because your husband has just already accepted the fact.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to, yes, but Katie is not about to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really hard. But there are a lot of losses like that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that they are the same as walking through the fire. Or a loss of a job, or loss of a profession. Or as we get older, the loss of being able to walk as far as we want to walk. All of those kinds of losses. The loss of not being able to sleep through the night. there are just lots of those kinds of things. And you think, you know, it's just one more fire I'm walking through. But how do we get through those losses? I mean, is there anything that we learn from them? How do we keep from being consumed? I mean, that is my question. How do we keep from being consumed by those losses? Because we all know people who have been. Is that right? I know people who have been consumed by their losses. So my question is, how do we, as Christians, keep from having that happen? I think one way is to read this Bible verse over and over again, you know, when you're in the midst of it, or read the 23rd Psalm.
Or build a support system when you're not in,
yes,
that situation. I mean,
right,
in anticipation of perhaps this could happen someday.
Right, yeah. How about the book of Job? Have any of you studied the book of Job at all? It's such a fascinating book. Such a fascinating book. What does Job say about walking through the fire? Where's God as he walks through the fire?
He knows God's always with him.
That's the conclusion of the book of Job, isn't it? That is the huge message. It's not that I'm going to not lose my spouse or my children or my job or my home, or not get boils all over my body. That's not what the book says. It says God will be with you through it, as you go through these things.
And we kind of kid ourselves and think that life is going to go just merry, rosy, and whatnot.
Right?
And that's not really the plan.
Right. I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there is a church which doesn't really have a name, but it has a university, which is called Oral Roberts University. We Lutherans call it a cult, but it's an enormous religion in Oklahoma. And part of their theology is what I would call the theology of, the theology of riches, or the theology of
glory.
Well, it's different than that, though. What I'm trying to say is that they believe that if you lead a godly life, God will give you riches. And that if you are poor, God doesn't like you very well. You're not doing the right things. It's extremely offensive to me.
Talking about material.
Material riches. Things. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm talking about that. Yes. Mm-hmm. And they talk about this over and over again. And a lot of people, I think, are getting really, really hurt by that, hearing that mm-hmm. message. And wow, that's certainly not the message in the book of Job at all. But I think it's interesting because it's not something that's going away. It's something that's getting bigger and bigger as the people in our country get richer and richer. They need to somehow reconcile it with their belief, their Christian belief, and so they say, "Oh, America is this Christian nation, therefore that's why we're getting, you know, economically stronger." And I think they're getting on a real, real shaky
dangerous slippery slope.
Yeah, it isn't the theology of the cross.
No, it certainly is not. It's about as opposite as you can. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I'm going to do this one. And I read this one last night too, but I want to talk about this. Actually, I got some of these in my pocket.
What, M&M?
No, they're up in my room. No, this is sea glass. In case some of you haven't seen it, try not to collect it at the end because this is my favorite stuff, so you can't keep it.
What is it?
This is sea glass. So you can see what it is, what it looks like if you have never seen sea glass before.
Let's see.
Yeah. Do you have some sea glass? Okay. Anyway, you can see as you look at it, this was something else. I mean, this was some kind of a white bottle, and it got thrown overboard from a ship or whatever, and it got worked over in the waves, you know, over and over. It's hitting the sand, it's hitting the shells, and it comes out looking like this. And I've gotten to looking for sea glass now instead of for shells, because I have too many shells and I don't have anywhere to put them anymore. So I started looking for sea glass, and I love this. But anyway, that's what this poem is. So now you know what that looks like. Redemption. Dust to dust, sand to sand, glass returns from the sea, changed. This piece, found on a walk on a day when I was looking down, tired of shells, tired of sand dragging my body along a going nowhere beach, I spotted faint pink of returned glass, frosted by a vicious wave. Had it been a bottle of French perfume flung overboard in the storm? A glass tray broken? A bottle of lotion emptied and worthless? Water broke it, slashed it, grated it on shells, and spit it out, like Jonah on the beach, finally doing what he was told. Warming in sunlight above the dead strewn shells, his face toward Nineveh, his will worked over and worn, becoming one with the white, white sand. Now I put this on here because I really love the metaphor of the sea glass being something, I mean, it is what it used to be. This is the same piece of glass it's always been, but it's really different, isn't it? And how did it get different?
by being born.
Went through the fire, didn't it? Or the equivalent, anyway, of going through the fire.
So what would we be like if we hadn't experienced anything?
Right.
Would we be worth anything?
I talked in my class one of the other days about the fact that I think that builds character. I think that's where character comes from.
I think we get stronger through adversity.
Yeah, I don't think we're born with character. And we're certainly not born with strength. I think that's, strength is something that we work on. And it comes from many different places. And from faith is one of the places it comes from. But it also comes from having gone through something and survived it. And maybe it was the faith that helped us survive it. But this sea glass comes back more beautiful than it went in, I think. And of course, when it broke, it had very sharp edges on it. Now it's very smooth and beautiful, and I love it. And so I call this poem Redemption, which is really been redeemed. It was something else, and now it was something, and now it's something else. But it's more beautiful.
That makes me think of older women's faces.
Uh-huh.
There's so much, the wrinkles and the aging and the depth you can see there. And it's a world of experience and wisdom.
I agree. Do you find it in old men's faces as well?
Some.
Not as many.
I guess I think of women.
Right. Well, I see it in more old women's faces than old men's. But in my experience, especially in the counseling experience, I find that men have been very, very focused on a job until retirement, and they haven't focused as much on all those other holistic kinds of things. And they have a lot to catch up on after they retire. Not all, I'm not saying all, but many. But
and also society, and that is changing certainly, as we've said. But I haven't been allowed to show emotion.
Yes. Oh, right. Yes, it's been a terrible disservice that we've done for them. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to think of all the men who are here right now, though, with the group from Westlake. And I would say that, yeah, there are some men here who have been well-worn and are full of character. Mm-hmm. Which is fun because
of the fire.
Yeah. Interesting stories.
Yeah. And I've told many people that some of the most, I don't know if interesting is the right word, I think some of the people that I know with the greatest character are people who belong to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, because they have walked through the fire and they've been forced to examine it. Not just walk through fire, but forced to examine it and to make changes. And of course, AA is based on the support of God, as you know him or her, however. But I have always found that, and that's really interesting. And that's kind of what you're saying about the men that are visiting this week as well. So, yeah, they're kind of all like sea glass. Okay, let's see here. If you are at all inclined to write, how many of you have ever written poetry or write in your spare time? Anybody?
A little bit? Long, quite a while ago.
Okay. I guess one of the things that I would encourage, And I do this, I wouldn't encourage it if I didn't do it in my own life, but I've been doing this my entire life. I write, and the more I write, the more I discover about myself. And I have my clients do this all the time. There's certain people that won't do it, but the ones who will do it really do discover a lot about themselves. And what I would suggest if you'd like to start writing would be to think about this. How hard is it to hear God or find meaning amidst the roar of the fire? And think about one time in your life, one particular time when you felt like you walked through the fire. How did you get through it? How did you keep from getting burnt or consumed by it? What did you learn from it? Do you feel that your character changed because you went through that? You know, what kinds of things did you learn as you went through it? And where was God through it? Did you feel God as you went through the fire? Or did it take a while afterwards? You know, as you were saying, sometimes you don't. Did it take a while afterwards to look back and say, gee, God was there the whole time? So think about those things if you'd like to start writing. That's a good thing to start writing about. Does anybody have any questions? Let's see, I've got a couple more poems here that I could do. Let me do this little one. This is a very short little one. This poem's called, let me look, Paisley Dress of Purple. And it's about when my father died. I was 13 when my father died. It was probably the first time that I felt like I walked through the fire. And this is a very short little poem about it. Paisley dress of purple. When she asked what I'd wear, I knew it would be paisley. Dark and wiggling fabric draped over my tight shoulders. This fabric massaging flesh and something else deeply wounded in my 13-year-old frame. I love the shapes of paisley as they whirl and twist, colors blending into the last light of sunset, the almost dark time when shades of purple spread across the sky, creep into air and take over my breath. I chose the paisley dress for Father's funeral, its dim light all that was left of day. Now, I look at this poem, and when I wrote this, you know, I was just recreating what I remembered feeling at the time. But as I looked back at this poem after having written it, I'm looking back that even during all of the horrible things that happened at this time, I still remember that dress which was hanging in my closet, and I chose that one. Not something black or brown, but I chose that one because it had these beautiful colors that were twisting and curling, and it was dark enough so I could get by. But I knew that my dad would want me to wear something that had these beautiful curling colors. And things like that are the things that, that kind of pull you through these times. When you look back and you say, oh yeah, I could feel God was there and there and there, and that's how I got to be able to walk through. And that's just one of those little things. And I guess what I'm saying here is that, and just like with that loss poem, that the loss doesn't have to be this enormous loss. It can be some small loss that we're walking through. And we need to pause at the time and say, okay, how do I feel the support of God? How do I know that He's calling my name through this? And I will not be consumed by what's going on here. And just to ask that question. And if you don't come up with an answer, put it down on paper and write it out. You know, if you want to do it in the form of a poem or a journal or whatever. But that's what I would suggest. Does anybody have any comments or questions?
Be in touch with familiar and comfortable things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Peter, what's his last name? The
tourist.
Was saying the other morning, or yesterday morning, we were talking about, you know, what it would be like to be a refugee.
Right.
And losing everything familiar and comfortable.
Right.
And how would you get in? I mean, I just can't imagine if something happened in this country, mm-hmm. and we lost everything and we had to go somewhere else where we didn't know the language, we couldn't keep a job or get a job, because if you're a professional person,
right.
if you had a trade, you could do that. I think about that often, and I don't know if I could do it. I mean, you have to. You do what you have to do.
Right.
But my daughter works with
refugees from Kosovo in Chicago. Oh. Uh-huh. And there were a couple of young people at her wedding, a brother and sister. And he is working on his pharmacy degree right now. And he had almost attained that before they had to leave the country. Mm-hmm. And his sister is working with children. Now, I'm not sure what she did before they left. Lost their father to gunshots outside the front of their house as they were leaving the back of their house. I mean, I can't begin to imagine.
Right.
And how you would have something. Yeah.
Right.
How you could hang on to. And probably the less you have, in a way, the more you have to hang on to. The more you would hang on to God.
Right. Did you hear the devotion this morning at breakfast? I think it was this morning.
Yeah, the backpack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly that. Mm-hmm. You know, the man was saying, you know, what terrible thing did you do that you have to carry all of this on your back? Right. Yeah, that's, I thought that was very, very insightful.
My first job was visiting elderly people who were on old age assistance, and they lived on $97 a month. And I had no problem finding them because whatever was a shack was where they lived, you know, when I was driving to home.
Yeah.
And to the person, they were extremely happy and much happier than the other people I knew from the rest of our life, uh-huh. from church and everywhere else.
And what sustained them?
Well, they had to have faith. And yeah. What else did they have?
Right.
They had
right.
Faith.
Right.
Life becomes so complicated with all of our stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you could just, I've thought, I mean, I'd hate to have a fire that would consume everything that I owned, but on the other hand, you know, it you could start fresh. You wouldn't right. have all this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, material things that I can't part with, and yet I really don't want to have.
Right. Right. Well, I don't. I keep forgetting, you know, who's in what class, but one of my classes, one Monday or Tuesday, I told a story about a woman minister of mine when I lived in Hawaii, and she was very, very lonely, and she had just moved to this church that we went to, and she had just moved there because in her former home, and I don't even know where that was, the home had burned to the ground, and she had lost absolutely everything that she owned. And she said the only way that she could start getting her life back together was that all of her friends sent her back the photographs that she had sent to them over her lifetime, so that someone sent a picture of her wedding that they had, and a picture of the baptism of her kids, and all those kinds of things. That's right. And she started putting together her photo albums, and she said, once she could get her photo albums put back together, she didn't care if she lost everything. but I thought that was so beautiful to think that she got back what she had given away.
I don't know if I was sitting and trying to think if this really is, you know, relates, but I'll just tell you something that's on my heart, thinking of the way that different people, that we all look in a different way at things. You remember the Oklahoma bomber? Yeah, the young man. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, we all had different feelings and things yeah. about him. And then the night before, the day that he was executed,
yeah.
in the paper came out and said he didn't leave. He didn't leave any document that said he was sorry. He didn't leave anything behind except his favorite poem. Did anybody else read that? Because here is this, it was by John Masters, I think, and here is a poem that my husband and I have always loved all of our lives, because we had a teacher in as seniors in high school English who, Miss Byerly, this was a favorite poem of hers, which she gave to us and emphasized that this is, you are the person that are making your own lives. In the end, God may be with you, but in the end, you are the person that decide this and go. And I sat down and bawled because here was this young man who had somebody, somewhere, he had taken the same poem, and look what he did. He felt, you see, he felt that he had that purpose in life, and he was so covered up with it. And that is always, that has just really stuck with me. It's, you know, it goes, out of the night that covers me, black as a pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. Matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the captain of my fate. I am the of my soul, master of my soul. Yes. Well, you know, and I just, I mean, I'm still stunned when I think of that, because we love that poem, and we used to recite it to each other just as saying, now Miss Byerly would say, right. Don't worry about this. Take it on to yourself and then do with it what you want to. You don't have to succumb to because circumstances are twin. All of our lives, I mean, my husband is dead now, but all of our lives, you know, we used to think we would recite this to each other. Yeah. And then to suddenly have this young man, he didn't say anything about it, but he took it and he took what he. And you thought, my goodness, was this, I mean, he must have taken this as direction that he...
Right. You know, if you've gone to Peter Drury, the Pastor Drury's Bible studies in the morning, and by the way, if you have the time, do it, because he's wonderful. He has talked about this text context. And if you take a text out of context, it's not going to be right. It's not going to work. And that's what he did. That's what Timothy McVeigh did. He took the text out of context, and he made it into something that it wasn't meant to be.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what I think. That's what we really need as Christians. We need to do that. We have to remember the context that we are living in, and always remember that. And as we, you know, as we're walking through the fire, you know, that's the text, that's the story that we're living right now, but what context are we living in? You know, what's the safety net underneath us? You know, and he says, this shall not consume you. And that's what we have to remember. And that's the end.
Amen.
Thank you, Sandra.